This is Kate Turkington on Travels with Kate, only on 101.9 High FM.
And a very, very good morning to you from a gloriously sunny Johannesburg. Hasn't been too good, apparently, but I've been away. I've actually been in South America, and I want to tell you all about my travels. And remember, if you want to talk to me or send a message, SMS 34519. I've got my laptop here. I'll see your message as soon as it comes up. Or Telegram 061-895-1019. So let me tell you now about South America. I went to South America. I went to Brazil very briefly, but mainly to Argentina. Now, I wonder if you know this. Buenos Aires, the capital of Argentina, Buenos Aires, Buenos Good Aires Air, because when it was first discovered or settled, apparently it had the healthiest air one could possibly have. It's the capital of Argentina. And I wonder if you knew this. After New York, it's got the second biggest Jewish population in the entire world. I didn't know that. That was a totally new fact for me. And some of the very first Jews came to Buenos Aires in 1860. And apparently they came to establish agricultural colonies. So this was total news to me. And it's a very secular, wonderful, accepting city. I love Argentina. The people are friendly. And South America, Argentina, it's a bit always on the cusp, like South Africa. I mean, change is constant in South Africa, has been for thousands of years. And I think that's true too, particularly of Argentina, where they get new presidents all the time. And I said to one of our guides, you know, I hope I'm not being offensive, but the rest of the world thinks your president is mad. She said, well, we do. We do too. And in Buenos Aires, there are 30 different churches of different religions. Only one mosque. Isn't that amazing? 30 different churches. Incredibly, incredibly welcoming and just welcoming, I think. Pleased to see everywhere, everybody. And parks. And it's a beautiful city. It's got beautiful old colonial buildings from the time of the Spanish occupation. It's got wide boulevards, beautiful old street lamps. And I've never been in a city, I don't think, where there are so many parks and green spaces. I think because people are living probably in very small accommodation most of the time with no gardens or maybe not even a balcony, they tend to congregate, particularly of an evening, in the parks and the green spaces. So you've got people walking dogs. People love their dogs in Argentina. People walking dogs, people going into a cafe and having one coffee, rather like Paris. You buy a coffee and then you sit there for 3 hours and you just watch the world go by. Just lovely, lovely city. I'm going to tell you more in a moment.
This is Kate Turkington on Travels with Kate, only on 101.9 High FM.
Welcome back. I'm talking to you today about Argentina because I've just had the most exhilarating, sensational, exhausting trip to Argentina. And I'm telling you about Buenos Aires, the capital city of Argentina. It's on the River Plate, Plata. Silver. Well, one time there was silver discovered there. And apparently it's one of the most difficult rivers in the world to navigate. And the tugboat captains who bring the big ships in have to go to special schools or special universities to get their qualifications. Now, the ports, this is so interesting. It's not a port that is easy to get to. Let me explain. Every day, rivers, other rivers, come down from the north and they deposit silt into the port. So what happens every single day, had to write this down, some bad numbers, 4 million cubic meters of sand a day are taken out of that river to keep the port open. 4 million cubic meters of sand taken out of the river. And the river is so wide, you just keep thinking you're at the sea when you're in Buenos Aires, because the river, you can't see the horizon. The river just goes on forever. Now, I want to tell you some of the things I did. The first day, we did a whole tour of the city. We went to the very big cathedral there, beautiful, beautiful Catholic cathedral, because, of course, Argentina is mainly a Catholic country. Beautiful, beautiful. And two soldiers inside in full ceremonial uniform guarding one of the statues of the Virgin Mary. Then we went to a very, very famous cafe called the Café Tortone, where we had coffee and a local speciality called churros, which a bit like, yuck, what are they like? They look a bit like Cook Sisters, but they're not so sweet, but they're delicious. And then we went into the back room and we had a tango lesson. And I dance, of course, all the South American men absolutely drop dead gorgeous. I dance with the tango instructor, mind you, in tackies. It's a bit difficult to glide along there, but it was such fun. And then we went to the market, one of the many, many markets. There's a famous area where the immigrants first came called La Boca. Those of you who've been to Buenos Aires know that Caminito Street. Very colourful, very bohemian. Lots of stalls and vibey music. And we had lunch. Oh, my word. Now, I'm not a big meat eater, but the size of the steaks they served us, I think I ate a third of mine. I felt so guilty because I couldn't eat all of it. And then all around us are the street dogs. I mean, they're not like our street dogs. They're the fattest, well-fed, most loved street dogs that you could possibly see. But the food was absolutely wonderful, beautiful, beautiful beefsteaks. And in the 1950s, of course, Buenos Aires in Argentina was the richest city in the world. Can you imagine that in the 1950s, because of the beef and because of the sheep that are farmed there? Then after this amazing lunch, we tottered off to the Recoleta Cemetery, which is so famous. And I had been to Argentina two or three times. And my group, I must tell you, we were a group of 10, including my daughter, Tiffany, and myself. And there were 7 grannies in the group. I mean, of course, I'm older than anybody I know. But all ex-professional women who had now retired. And my word, the granny gang, as I called it, we were up for anything, and we did absolutely everything. Most wonderful bunch of clever, interesting, non-complaining, go-for-it women. So they had seen on the itinerary cemetery. And who wants to go to a cemetery? But the cemetery, I said to the guide in future, put on the itinerary a visit to the city of the dead, because this cemetery in Buenos Aires is like no other that you've ever find anywhere else in the world. It's a city. you have to put your name down when you're born to be buried in that cemetery. And plots are handed on from generation to generation. So the tombs, I mean, many of the tombs you could walk inside. They're huge, absolutely huge, with marble statues and angels and beautiful pathways with plants. It really is a city of the dead. And of course, we came to Eva Peron's grave. I'm sure many of you saw the movie or the musical Evita. Eva Peron, hated or totally loved, but a remarkable woman. And in spite of maybe a dodgy background, we went to the Evita Museum, where obviously we were fed all the good things and the propaganda. She had an inauspicious start, but she was ambitious and clever. And she finally became the first lady of Argentina, married Juan Perón when she was 25. She died at 35. In that 10 years, she changed that country from a very, I don't want to say primitive, can't think of a non-pejorative word, but she changed that country unbelievably. She got women the vote. She had been a very active union member. She was a film star, actually. She wasn't very good, but she was popular. And she got women the vote. She created shelters for abused women. She was the most remarkable woman. She also filled her own coffers. But for a young woman, aged 25, died of breast cancer at 35, she changed that country, the eighth biggest country in the world, immeasurably for good. So we were hoping to hear Don't Die For Me, Argentina. But go to the movie. I think Madonna's version of Don't Cry For Me, Argentina, is probably the best.
This is Kate Turkington on Travels with Kate, only on 101.9 High FM.
Okay, we're going to leave Buenos Aires and go down to the Iguazu Falls. Now, the Iguazu Falls, I think, are the widest in the world. Absolutely magnificent. So now we're going into jungle. We had to fly down. I've told you what a big country Argentina is. So we go into the national park for a full day viewing of the falls, which are magnificent. And there were monkeys and a coati. A coati looks a bit like one of our mongoose. It's got a sort of snout to it. Lots of beautiful birds and butterflies. Butterflies like you've never seen. Put your two hands together and spread your fingers. And that's one of the big, big blue ones. They are clouds of colourful butterflies. Some of them settle on you. I don't know what they're looking for, but clouds of butterflies. Then we got our passports and we crossed into Brazil to the Brazilian side of the falls. And really, there's not a great deal of comparison. It's a bit like Vic Falls. The Zimbabwe side you can't beat. The Zambian side is okay, but the Zimbabwe side is stupendous. Same with the Iguazu Falls. The view from the Brazilian side is breathtaking, sensational. Hot, hot, hot. I don't know how many steps I walked down, hundreds of steps. Thank goodness I didn't have to walk up. There was a lift, and I go into frail little old granny mode, you know, if there's a lift available finally. And I have a tattoo on my shoulder which says established 1934. So I flash that at whoever's looking and immediately get a wonderful response. So then we did a boat ride under the falls. Yes, you heard me, under the falls. We get into this, it was like a Zodiac, a rubber boat, about 12 people. And obviously we had ponchos and rain gear on, and we go through the white water stuff. And I've done white water rafting before. It's not rafting. So I'm sitting in the boat thinking, yeah, this is quite tame. Suddenly, they go right up to the falls, and we go through a waterfall, screaming. We got soaked with water up to our ankles. We had to change all our clothes in the public loo when we finished. But, oh, it was absolutely wonderful. And when you go to the Iguazu Falls, be sure to do that boat ride under the falls, because it is... it's a life-changing moment. As two of my group said, it was actually a life-changing moment for them. And we were very, very lucky, because just before our rubber dinghy came back to the docking point, by the way, they take you down the cliffs to the boat in a sort of funicular, like a little railway that takes you down before you get onto the boat. But as we came back to the dock, there was a herd, I don't know what the collective noun is, of Copibara, which is the biggest rodent in the world. It's a bit bigger than a warthog, and there were about 8 or 9 of them on one of the banks. They'd come down to drink. After the falls, another life-changing experience, we flew yet again down to Patagonia, to Argentinian Patagonia, for the great glaciers. So now we go from 40 degrees heat, literally, to freezing, and we get on another boat, a covered boat, which was actually very, very nice, which served us lunch. And we spent the whole day cruising the great glaciers. Words, I'm a wordsmith, but words fail me to describe these glaciers. One of them is like 40 kilometers long. You sail, well, I don't know what the word is, you chug up to these walls of ice, and you can't go, you go about 70 meters, let's say, from, you can't go any nearer because the glaciers are carving all the time. You know that word. The ice, chunks of ice are breaking off. They turn the engines off. There's total silence, and all you hear is the ice cracking and the ice falling into the water. And what is so sad, one of the particular glaciers we saw, and think of the horror of this, and this is global warming. I'm just looking at my notes here to get the actual figure. The Perito Moreno Glacier, which is one of the biggest, has retreated 80 kilometers in 11 years. 80 kilometers has melted away in 11 years. That tells you something about global warming. So again, a trip to the glaciers. The Americans call them glaciers. I can't do it. I'm sorry. I'm an English scholar. A trip to the glaciers is absolutely essential. So we limp back to the hotel that evening. Beautiful hotel in the jungle to try and recover. And then finally we go back to Buenos Aires. So in 8 days we did 8 flights, because the country is so big. But if you want to see the Iguazu Falls, if you want to see the glaciers, you've got to be prepared to do this. And in South America, it's the time is very like our time and like Irish time. So at one stage they said, you've got to be at the airport at 5 o'clock, all the flights have changed, get to the airport. No, now it's all been delayed for 3 hours. So you accept all this. And if you're traveling in a group, you know, it's fun and you can chat and whatever. But you've got to go to Argentina. It's affordable for South Africans. You know, as a travel writer, you're not allowed to say cheap, but it is just about affordable. And what was so interesting, on the plane home, you fly from Buenos Aires to Sao Paulo in Brazil, which is just above Rio. Then you fly from Sao Paulo back to Johannesburg. We had a bit of a hiccup because we were a third of the way home from Sao Paulo to Johannesburg, and there was a medical emergency on board. So we had to turn around, fly all the way back to Sao Paulo to offload the medical emergency. We had to stay on the plane while they refueled. So our flight was actually 16 hours in all. I was very lucky because I had a bulkhead seat so I could stretch my legs. But I sat next to an Israeli doctor who was just traveling for a holiday to South Africa, who'd just come from Israel, and his stories were incredibly interesting too. But what was so interesting is that the plane was packed with Brazilians, 400 people, Argentinians, all coming to South Africa for holidays. So we've still got something, we've still got a lot going for us. Okay, so we're going to go now from South America home to South Africa. I'm going to go to the bush. I'm going to go to a book I so enjoy because, you know, regular listeners know how I love the bush, and I have a grandson who's actually a game ranger, but I've just read an amazing book called Called by the Wild, and it's not your usual book about the bush or game ranging or wildlife, because it's about Comrade de Rosner's, who's my guest, how he has trained dogs to protect wildlife. We all know about the poaching problems in South Africa. What Conrad has done, he's trained dogs. The book is called Called by the Wild, published by Jonathan Ball. Welcome, Conrad, to the program.
Thank you very much.
Okay, I've got all kinds of questions for you, as you can imagine. Now, you were one of the first game rangers to focus on working with specially trained dogs to protect wildlife from poachers. So tell us, Comrade, how did it all begin?
It all began growing up on family game reserves. There was two family game reserves. The one was in Zululand, and then the other game reserve was just south of the Kruger National Park in Malalan, near Malalan, called Morrisdale Game Reserve. And, of course, we had family dogs, and we would run around the bush with our family dogs. But really, in those days, we did not really know what we were doing in terms of specialized training and specialized operations with working dogs in the natural environment. So the process took quite a few years, actually, a few decades. And so what happened was, game rangers were using dogs in their everyday life, and obviously people were hunting with dogs as well, bird hunters, etc. But the specialist application in terms of counter-poaching operations started in earnest pretty much about 20 years ago. In terms of starting to apply the correct training, etc., to
and
the
how,
working dogs.
I mean, we all know how difficult it is to tell a dog to sit or come or fetch. Tell us about the training. What do you do? Go get that lion, go get that poacher. How do you do it?
Okay, so it's quite a process. We get the dogs in as young puppies, and we source the dogs from specific working lion breeders, breeding pairs of dogs that have genetic traits that are ideally sort of situated towards working lion dogs. So there are only a handful of breeders in South Africa that actually supply the correct genetics that we're looking for, high drive working dogs. And that process then starts from a young age. The puppy will go out, and often, in fact, the young puppies are learning from our older dogs. Yeah. So we pair up a younger dog with an older dog that knows what's going on in the bush. and including the handler as well and the trainer. And we then, it's a gradual, it's about, well, from puppy going up to about 2 years, whereby the dog will then be qualified and receive its certification to operate as a service dog in the industry.
And how, comrade,
it takes
as I
quite
said
a lot
a bit
of
earlier, we all know
extensive
how,
training from most the.
Sorry, I was saying, I said a bit earlier, we all know the problems with poaching. How effective has your in your experience, how effective are the dogs?
The dogs have definitely been what all the rangers are saying, a game changer in terms of we are having many successes nowadays with the using of the service dogs. There are three main categories or functions that the dogs are performing. Number one, which is detection of contraband or bushmeat or blood. So the dog is sniffing out and indicating the presence of a substance. Number two is dogs following a human scent trail, being able to accurately do so reliably. And then the third function, which is the much lesser of all three functions, is to be able to apprehend a criminal suspect with the use of the dog actually apprehending the suspect with bite on the arm. We normally train for only on the arm, but very seldom does the third function come into play. However, some of the canines are trained to perform this function, and it's normally if we are faced with a serious threatening situation from humans.
Well, I know, and you write about it in the book, your life has been in danger several times. Tell us about, maybe before you do that, tell us about your special dog, Zingela. She was I was quite surprised to see she was a Weimaraner. I didn't know Weimaraners were sort of hunting dogs.
Yes, so Zingela, he was like literally my like partner and soulmate in the years that we worked together, for the 6.5 years we worked together. Zingela, I got him as a young puppy, and he grew up by my side day in, day out, every day, every night, and very quickly started to learn about how to operate and function in the bush. That is on a big game reserve, which is Bongani Mountain Lodge, where there's Big Five. And so the Weimaraner is a very interesting breed. The Germans bred Weimaraners. It's about a 300-year-old breed. They bred the Weimaraners as a companion on the hunting field. And the one aspect of a Weimaraner, and this is why I chose to get a Weimaraner in the first place, was that they are also capable and will willingly protect their owner, their handler. And that was one of the key factors in making that decision about a Weimaraner as opposed to some other kind of bird or hunting dog. And so the hunting dogs, very important, is that their function is also to indicate the presence of blood and or any dead animals or bushmeat, etc. And they are also able to track and follow a human scent trail as well, especially if there's odor of residual dead animal scent on them, etc.
Now you write in the book that Zingela saved your life on a couple of occasions. Tell us about those experiences.
Okay, so I'll give some of it away, but the rest is in the book. But
tell us, so, because it'll send people to the book. Tell us, come on.
Okay. So the main thing was that. And where it really came into play in terms of how I knew I'd made the right decision was the one day we were down on a river and I was checking for snares, and Zingela always loved playing in the water in the shallow streams, looking for dragonflies and fish. His favorite pastime was looking for fish in the clear waters. And obviously there was no crocodiles that high up in the mountain valley. So I would let him go into the shallow stream and look for fish and play around, whilst I was looking for snares on the game trails coming in and out of from the river bed there. And so immediately Zingela got scent of something and jumped up the riverbank, ran up the riverbank and started barking with a fury that I'd never seen before. And it was literally quite shocking to watch how furious or how aggressive he was barking. And I knew, because I'd been told by my grandfather, my uncle, never ever go up a drainage line and expose yourself without looking first. So I was like, no ways, this is too dangerous. I'm going to go around this massive granite boulder and come back from the other side, the back. What was very amazing was that Zingela stayed where he was. He didn't follow me. He stayed where he was, alerting to the threat. I came around the back of this massive granite boulder, and there was two field rangers, shockingly so.
This is Kate Turkington on Travels with Kate, only on 101.9 High FM.
I'm talking to Comrade about his book, Comrade de Rosner, who he wrote with Graham Spence and his mum, Elaine Bell, who does a lovely sort of introduction to the book. And Comrade, you left us, well, we left you hanging there. You've got Zingela barking in a fury you've never seen. There's a big granite boulder. You don't want to go up the drainage line because you know it's dangerous. You go round the boulder. Zingela surprisingly doesn't follow you, and you find two field rangers. What did that mean?
Yes. So these field rangers were not under my employ. They were provincial field rangers, which means they're working for a government department and not for any private company. So what happened was, is I was very alarmed because these rangers were both aiming their rifles directly at Zingela. Yeah. And I knew, okay, these guys are waiting for me to come up behind the dog. And all the hairs in the back of my neck raised up, and I knew this is a deadly, dangerous situation. And my vehicle was parked about 40 meters away, and they would have been able to see my vehicle. These rangers knew my vehicle as well. So it was very obvious that they were trying to wait for me to come up behind the dog. And I had this foreboding feeling. So I actually ended up putting them on point with my firearm and telling them to drop their rifles. They went shades of gray because they were so scared at me surprising them from the rear. They dropped their rifles. I approached them very cautiously. Zingela was on guard the whole time. And I then stripped their rifles through the pieces of the working parts in different directions. That would give me time to get away. And I was not trying to arrest them. It was two words against one. And then I got in my vehicle after warning these guys that, listen, if you try this on me again, the next time it will be you on the receiving end and not me. And I then departed. And actually, unfortunately, I had to leave the game reserve because of that. And then carried
Why?
On.
Why? Because you were recognized or?
Yes. I was a threat to these, yeah, to those field rangers, because they were involved with poaching of buffalo. In fact, they were mainly hunting buffalo on that game reserve and selling the meat to villages surrounding the reserve. And I was interfering with their illegal business, so to say.
And comrade, yeah, that brings us to something you write about, the title of one of your chapters, The Dark Side. Poachers, we know, there are the very organized gangs, blah, blah, blah. But you talk about the enemy within, and you have just mentioned two enemies within. Just explain what you mean by that.
Okay, so unfortunately, in the world of conservation and in many different disciplines of conservation, field rangers who are working out there supposedly supposed to be protecting these game reserves from poachers coming in there and killing animals, quite frequently become involved with the criminal syndicates themselves, and they act as inside spies for the criminal gangs running around outside, and actually sometimes they are even engaged in poaching themselves. And unfortunately, this is one of the scourges of conservation in terms of having rangers that are not trustworthy and are actually illegally hunting animals themselves to make more money. And obviously it's all financial or money bound. This is a very sad thing. And it happens in more places than most people understand, and more often than most people understand. But the game rangers that are out there that are working in the bush and have been for the last 20, 30 years are very well aware of the situation.
And, you know, one sometimes reads some very senior members in the parks have been caught and prosecuted, even the vets, some of them. And before we leave the whole sort of poaching story, the rhino poaching, which we know is so bad, are we winning that battle, do you think?
So at the moment, a certain sense of balance is being maintained on many of the private game reserves, and especially also on the western side of the Greater Kruger National Park system, where there have been some large units which are installed into these specific properties to protect the free roaming rhino populations there. So there is a balance being kept. There are still animals being rhinos being poached. So it is a pretty much a precarious balancing point at this stage. However, in some of the provincial parks and some of the national parks, you know, the rhinos have really been slaughtered wholesale, and they've got some serious issues that they're dealing with. Many of those situations or sometimes turn out to be internal problems. In the private sector, we are polygraphing our rangers. So we put them on polygraphs or lie detector tests, and we can very quickly see if there's any deception involved in there's normally five questions asked in different order, and we will be able to identify if someone is deceiving us or telling lies.
Goodness.
Or untruth.
Goodness, I mean, what has the world come to, game rangers having lie detector tests? But you also have a chapter. I was very, very lucky. You know, I've been going to the bush for, I think, longer than you've been alive, comrade, but I only saw my first pangolin last year, actually, in Madikwe, the most wonderful sighting, just on my own, and with the ranger and two members of my family. But pangolins, you, which are the most poached animal in the world, you've got a chapter called Hope and Despair. Explain that to us.
So we have been noticing an alarming increase in the amount of trafficking of pangolins. Remember that the people who are catching pangolins or finding them in the wild are attempting to sell them alive because they fetch more money alive. Uh-huh. And it's not like they're selling them directly just for the meat itself, like the bushmeat poachers. So these animals are the most trafficked animal in the world, and there's a huge price tag attached to them. I'm actually not even allowed to say how much, because that price range varies depending on how high up the ladder it goes. The thing is that there are very concerted efforts being made to mitigate or minimize the amount of pangolin trafficking happening. And it's like going into the world of James Bond kind of stuff, deep down into the underground and the trafficking networks, and trying to intercept these animals before they die or get killed or before they get shipped overseas to the markets where their end destination is. So it is a constant battle and a constant challenge to stay on top of this. Yes, we are seeing pangolins out in the wild and free roaming, and there are quite a large number of them. One of the other threats to pangolins as well is not even just human beings. It is also electric wires at the bottom of the game fences, yes. Predator wires. And that has killed also many pangolins. And if you look at it, that is also a human cause. That pangolin, if it wraps around the electrical wire and gets electrocuted to death, that's a human cause. Humans caused that to happen. So great efforts are being made to actually redesign the wiring tripwires at the bottom of the game fence in order to stop that.
Okay, comrade, stay with us. We're taking a short break, then we're coming back.
This is Kate Turkington on Travels with Kate, only on 101.9 High FM.
Oh, Marion, thanks for your comments. And remember, when you're listening, you can SMS me at 34519 or you can telegram 061-895-1019. And we're listening to Comrade de Retzer talking about his experiences in the bush. Lovely book called Called by the Wild, The Dogs Trained to Protect Wildlife. It's published by Jonathan Paul. Now, Comrade, what would you like to see happen? If you had a magic wand, what would you like to see happen with regard to the poaching? Is there, in other words, I'm asking you the impossible, really. Is there a solution?
So, you know, that is, in fact, a very, very difficult question to answer. I'm going to give it a go because it's such a complex subject. And there are so many different factors that play a role in this situation. I will say one thing is that after COVID went away, there was a massive increase. I mean, the graph went from going at a 30 degree angle to an 80 degree angle upwards in terms of poaching. What we have found out now is that another main reason for the bushmeat poaching, and it's such the severity of it, and I can tell you right now, is that bushmeat poaching is by far the most serious threat to conservation in the world, actually. But in South Africa, the extreme most biggest threat to wildlife areas and wildlife and conservation. And one of the reasons for that is all of these illegal miners that are the Zamazamas, they call them, have now... of course got money because they're getting gold out of the ground wherever they're zama-zamaing. And this has caused a massive increase on bushmeat poaching from people that live in villages surrounding the game reserves. Now, because there is money flowing and it's because it's become a syndicated operation, there's very little hope at the end of the tunnel or light at the end of the tunnel that bushmeat poaching is going to go away. The way I see it is actually maintaining and keeping a balance so that there isn't total destruction. And this balance involves having well-trained rangers and their dogs and well-armed and kitted, equipped, and using with the use of other technologies such as cameras, etc., maintaining a vigil and a protection on the area. If I could wave a magic wand, I would deal with the Zamazamas, starting with those guys, because they're one of the nexus problems of the bushmeat poaching industry in this country. And then I would then go for the head of the snake with the rhino poachers and the pangolin traffickers. If I could wave a wand, I would go...
Okay, we seem to have lost Comrade. Here he is back again. We're having I can see I'm watching Comrade actually on a Zoom, and I can see he's in a game lodge. I can see that wonderful thatch roof above his head. But now and again, the connection gets a bit dodgy, Comrade. And just finally, I mean, let's hope there is hope. I mean, that's not a good way of putting it. But if you could describe your most memorable moment, again, a very difficult question for you because you've had a lifetime of memorable moments. But is there one moment as a final answer that you could give me? Your most memorable moment.
Thank you for that. Another difficult question like that. There are many memorable moments, so I cherish every single experience, whether it's or obviously more so the positive ones than the negative ones. But I always learn from the negative ones. Most memorable moment would be, seeing, or even now today, seeing where canine conservation started from absolutely nothing to where we are today, the path and the road that led up from starting with nothing and getting up to today, which was from 2011 until now, has been the most memorable moment or time in my career of 33 years in the bush. From 2011 until now have been the most memorable because they've also been the most challenging in terms of getting canine conservation up and going and operating, where we are now working with in the region of 50 rangers out there.
Okay, regrettably, we're going to have to leave it next week. Could talk to you for ages, but thanks for all your doing, and congratulations on the book. By the way, has some great photographs in it as well. But thanks, and keep working, and keep please protecting our wildlife.
Thank you very much. Keep well. Bye.